Welcome. How's everybody feeling? Good? Now, if you want to have a good day, you people over here in the back need to come up. Come up further. I can see a bunch of people kind of sprinkled out in the back of the room. Boy, do we have a treat for you today. My name is Susan Jin Davis. I am Chief Sustainability Officer for Comcast Corporation. Comcast is a proud sponsor of the Pennsylvania Conference of Women. This is just a great place to come, not only to get some tools and resources, but also to get inspired and, importantly, to meet up with folks, whether it's old friends or to make new friends and to network. So we are really glad to have you here today. Now, Carolyn Webb will be our speaker today. And you all have her bio, so I'm not going to read it verbatim, but I do want to point out a few things. She is CEO of 7shift. And what's really interesting about what Carolyn does is that she marries business, and she's got a lot of experience as an economist over a number of different jobs throughout her career. She marries business with science. So we're going to learn a lot today, because the topic is how to have a good day. And I think that you can all agree with me that today, of all days, we need to have a good day. Yeah. There are so many things that happen to us that are out of our control. We saw a massacre in Las Vegas. We don't understand why. There is no way we could have controlled what happened. We are continuing to see coverage of the carnage and the horrendous effects of that event. Personally, a work friend of mine passed away this weekend. Another friend is going through a terrible experience with her family right now. Every one of these things are out of our control. So on the one hand, we say to ourselves, how do we let go and just accept that things are not in our control? Rely on faith, rely on our family, our friends, the love of the people around us, the things we love to do, the places we love to go to. How do we let go on the one hand? But on the other hand, what Carolyn is going to speak to us about, which is there are in fact ways that we can tweak the things that we do every day to bring a little good to our day, despite all the bad things, despite all the things we can't control that are happening around us. So it's really going to be a thrill to hear Carolyn. Now, a few fun facts about her. The first is, you know, she's actually walking around with a crutch, so you would actually never know this. But she was, in the 2012 Olympics, a dancer in the closing ceremony of the Olympics. She can't do that anymore. But she did do that. Which, by the way, is a very competitive thing, so that's one thing she does. And then the other little thing that she does in her spare time, between being an economist, a behavioral scientist, and speaking, and CEO, and all that stuff, is that she performs twice a year at Carnegie Hall as a vocalist. So she's clearly an untalented person who has nothing to share with us today. So another inspiring woman. So with that, I'd like to have Carolyn come up here, but before that, we just have to do this. So Carolyn, yeah. Why don't you come up here for a minute? Because you are so beautiful. So thank you very much. We will have a Q&A, and I give you Carolyn Webb.
Hello, Penn women. Oh my goodness. Oh my goodness. All the Penn women. And a few guys. I see a few guys too. Welcome everyone. Are you having a good day? You may not need me then, but just in case you do. Just in case tomorrow isn't quite so good and you're getting withdrawal from this amazing day that you're having today, I'm here to tell you a little bit about the science of what it takes for us to thrive. And I will say, first of all, that despite having written a book called How to Have a Good Day and being here to talk to you about how to have a good day, I will admit that not all my days have in fact been good ones. I know, this is... shocking admission. In fact, whenever I'm in front of a big audience, a bit dressed up, ready to give a talk, I'm reminded of a particular day that was quite early in my career. I'd actually just joined McKinsey, the consulting firm, I'd had a first career as an economist, but this was the first big project that I'd finished working on at McKinsey. And it was the end of the project, and my manager said, I'd like you to give part of the presentation. I was so excited. I was quite nervous as well. This was the final presentation to the clients with the recommendations. And you probably remember the very first time you got up to give a presentation, right? You know, you're a little nervous. You're a little nervous. But I was so on top of all of my material. I was really on top of my slides. And just to give you a bit of a sense of how old I am, this was the last presentation I did on actual acetate overhead slides. So yeah, I know like half of you are like, what is that? Yeah, so you know, had to do a lot of preparation to get all of these actual physical slides ready. So I was on that, I was so on top of that, it was great. But I was also thinking about my nervousness and how to kind of deal with that. And I was thinking, well, how can I project gravitas and presence into the room? It's what we're supposed to do as women, isn't it? You know? And so I was mostly doing this by walking around. I have to do this a little bit gently, given my hip. Walking around as boldly as I could. You know, really pulling myself up to full height. I didn't make that noise. And in my mind, it was working fantastically well. I was totally owning the room. And then there was this point where I made this especially emphatic comment, and I put my foot forward like that, and I heard a crack. So how many of you know what was about to happen to me? Yeah, so it turns out it is actually entirely possible for the heel on a high-heeled shoe to shear off completely, like break off, yeah? Yeah. Honestly, before it happens to you for the first time, you don't know that this is a thing. So there we are. As I was lying on the floor, no kidding, it turned out to be very difficult to project any further gravitas or presence into the room. So, you know, we do have things that go wrong. There are plenty of things we don't control. Honestly, mostly in the workplace, it's not wardrobe malfunctions, not most of the time. It's more likely to be tech failures or people failures, dare I say it. But as Susan said, you know, we have all of these things that we can't control. But I've always been interested in where's the wiggle room? Like, what is there that we can do to both acknowledge the hassles and the horrible things that happen and to be honest with ourselves about what's going on and also be smart about looking for ways around and through. And that's a philosophy that I call realistic optimism. I think the realism probably came from the fact that I first started working when I was 14 and I had a series of kind of pretty low rent jobs. And then my parents, I saw them in a series of less than ideal jobs, and mostly not in jobs that were fulfilling for them. And so I knew that, you know, life could have its ups and downs. I knew that there were plenty of chances that people and that myself would end up on a given day doing work that I didn't absolutely love, not right now. So that's perhaps the reason for my realism. My optimism, well, perhaps that's a personality thing to some extent, but actually my optimism comes substantially from the wonders of behavioral science. You know, behavioral science is the guys in neuroscience, guys meaning gender-neutral version of guys, right? The people in neuroscience, in psychology, in economics, who are interested in explaining human behavior, why we behave and think and feel the way that we do, and why other people behave and think and feel the way they do. And it turns out that there's a lot of good news in this, because we actually do only need a tiny amount of understanding of how our brains work to explain a lot of what goes on that seems inexplicable, and to give us a sense of where might be the tiny tweaks that we could make the tiny, tiny changes that we can make that would have disproportionate impact on our ability to feel great and to equip other people around us to feel good. And the upshot of knowing that little bit of behavioral science is that we do have a little bit more control over our everyday lives than we often tend to think. And I'm going to demonstrate that by talking about four things. I could talk about 100, but I picked these four because I think that they nicely cover the ground. I'm going to talk first of all about something existential, like how can you change the way that reality feels to you at any given moment? Like, that's pretty deep, right? That's a woo, like, can I change reality? Yes, you can change reality. We're going to start with that. So that's useful on days when you're feeling a bit low, a bit, your mood isn't great, situation around you doesn't seem great. I'm going to talk about how you can create more time in the day. How many of you would like more time in the day? Yay! All right. Yeah, so let's get then super practical. Then I want to talk about something intellectual. How can you boost your intelligence on demand? And then I'm going to talk about something emotional. How can you remote control other people's moods, like I'm remote controlling these slides? Does that sound like a reasonable place to start? Just a taster. But four things that could give us a sense of control where sometimes it's lacking. Okay. Are we ready? Yes. Okay. All right. Let's talk about reality. Wouldn't it be great if we could see more dogs in hats in general? So I said realistic optimism. I can't promise you that. But I would like to talk about what we can do to see more dogs in hats if they exist. I'll tell you a story from a little bit further on in my career, which was another day where I was in a meeting. And this was a meeting that was at the beginning of a project, not the end. I was actually pretty cranky that morning. I was working on this project because someone senior had said, I think you should work on this project. So how many of you got something on your to-do list that you're not totally excited about? Okay, so this was that thing. The project I wasn't super excited about. I was working alongside a guy called Lucas. And Lucas was quite different to me. He was very excited about 300-page PowerPoint decks. He was all over the analysis. Really into the numbers. And I was put on the project to bring the people dimension, the people side of things. So I wasn't wild about the project, but I thought, okay, fine, I'll get on board and we'll complement each other, me and Lucas. He'd been on board for a week before I started work on the project. So he'd set up the initial meeting with our customers, with the clients. And I was really grumpy about the way it had been set up. Because I had a sort of feeling that when you first start working with a client, you should meet them in person. There's something about being able to look into someone's eyes and actually be with them. You get to know them in a way, don't you? So I really felt that we should be meeting them in person, but we were not. We were doing a video conference, right? And it was a really grim video conference room. It was sort of long and thin and dark and low ceilings. And so I walked in, wasn't happy about being on the project, wasn't happy about this being the setup for the first meeting. I was like, how am I supposed to bring the people side if the clients aren't even here? They're on a screen in front of me. Anyway, so I knew it wasn't going to be a good meeting. And I was right. There were lots of people kind of frowning, lots of people talking over each other, lots of sort of small disagreements. I mean, nothing wild. No one punched anyone, but, you know, it didn't feel good. It didn't feel like a good kickoff meeting for a project. So I thought afterwards, I should sit down with Lucas and tell him about my concerns. We've got off on the wrong foot with the clients. So I do that, feeling quite virtuous about, you know, having this sort of quite difficult conversation. And I can still picture him sitting not far from me, listening to me talking about my concerns. And he gradually crossed his arms and started shaking his head. He said, Caroline, I don't know what you're talking about. Do you not remember the moment where the client said, this is a great meeting. Do you not remember the points where they said this is a really good foundation for the work we're going to do together? Don't you remember the moment where we all laughed about that hilarious thing that happened with the coffee? And the thing is that I didn't think he was completely crazy. I could just about on the edge of my consciousness accept that what he was saying was right. He wasn't making it up. But the thing is, it wasn't part of my experience of the meeting. And it was more than the fact that we had different personalities. It was just as if we'd experienced the 2 hours completely differently. And so I said to myself, okay, well, what on earth? WTF, you know, what happened there? And specifically, how did he have so much better a time than I did, since we're interested in having a good day, right? So it turns out that this is actually one of the deepest pieces of science that we know about our brains. It comes from the fact that your brain is wonderful, it is amazing, but the conscious part of your brain actually has some limitations. It's a bit like a delicate, sensitive professor. You know, it's very smart, it does a lot of reasoning and self-control and planning, but it can actually only process a certain amount of information at any given time. The conscious part of your brain is the bit that you're using to listen to me, and the bit that I'm using, yes, you see, and the bit that I'm using to speak to you. And if it tried to take in every piece of data that was around it at any given time, it would crash like an overloaded computer. Because you think about what's around you. There are trillions of pieces of data in the room. Like, if you lean over and look at the person next to you in a totally non-creepy way, look at every hair on their head, every strand, and each the color of it, and the way that the light falls on it, right? These are pieces of data. So, of course, there's trillions of pieces of data around us. Things that people are saying, doing, objects, noises. We can't actually process them all. Your brain would hang like an overloaded computer if it tried to. So, excellent, excellent solution. It turns out that your subconscious, the automatic part of your brain, is lightening the load on the conscious part of your brain by filtering out a ton of stuff. Just making sure that the conscious part of your brain only selects a few things to pay attention to. That's a phenomenon that cognitive scientists call selective attention. You've got a bit of attention, so you have to select where you put it. You don't have infinite attention. So it's a bit like you're looking down a pair of binoculars, and all you actually see is the bit that's in focus, and there's all of this stuff around that you miss. Things that people are saying and doing. And the big opportunity for us, because there's one conclusion here, is like, oh, well, we're really dumb, we miss a ton of stuff. But actually, it's better than that. It's a lot better than that. The thing is that there's a predictability to what you notice consciously and what you filter out, what you filter in and what you filter out. And it works like this. Your brain likes you to notice things that match what's already top of mind for you. So whatever is already top of mind for you will tell your brain, ah, okay, seems to be relevant. Make sure you see that and don't see that. So I'll give you an example. There was a study done at Harvard with radiologists. You know what radiologists do. They look at x-rays and other scans of our bodies to see if there are things that are broken or problematic. And this group of radiologists had a stack of lung scans that they were going through and looking out for nodules in the lungs. In the last of the lung scans, there was printed a picture of a plastic gorilla. So, how many of the radiologists saw the gorilla? 83% of the radiologists did not see the gorilla. I find it hard to believe every time I say it. Despite the fact that eye tracking devices showed that they looked directly at it, despite the fact that the gorilla wasn't tiny, it was 44 times the size of the average lung nodule. And despite the fact that these are people who are trained to spot abnormalities, Don't let that worry you. But the point is, you know, these were people who were kind of doing a serious job, and they were still capable of filtering out the gorilla. Now, why didn't they see the gorilla? They weren't looking for it, right? It wasn't their aim. They didn't wake up in the morning and say, you know what, I'm gonna look for a gorilla, right? So they came into that task not expecting to see a gorilla. They had no assumption they were gonna see a gorilla. So they did not see it. Brain decided that wasn't relevant, and that's how powerful the filtering mechanism is. It's not just actually objects that we are able to filter out, because you might be thinking, well, how big a deal is it if I don't notice my colleague's fantastic new top or amazing new hairstyle? I mean, whatever, right? It's more subtle than that. It turns out that if I were to split you guys into two groups, and you've all decided that you want to sign up for a psychology experiment, and I'm a mad, bad scientist in a white coat. Pretend my jacket is a white coat. And I decide to give you all a test. It's not a difficult test. I just give you all a test. And I put you guys randomly in a bad mood by telling you that you failed the test. It's not a big deal. You're bigger than that, right? But it would just tick you off a little bit, right? You guys, you're good. Then I give you all a description of an individual, and it's written really carefully to be really neutral. Really neutral. And I ask you guys, all of you, how likable is this person? So what happens? You guys think this person is perfectly likable. You guys, because you're in a bad mood, perceive this person as less likable. That's how subtle it is. Whatever our attitude is, as well as our aim and our assumption, is going to filter what we see. Now, here's the big opportunity, which you might have spotted, which is that our starting point when we go into anything, a conversation, a day, a task, enormously determines what seems to happen. And you kind of know this, because sometimes you wake up, you fall out of bed, you spill coffee on yourself, and everybody is a jerk. Have you ever had that experience? That's getting out of bed on the wrong side, our grandmothers told us. Turns out grandmother was right. Because if you are in a bad mood, what are you gonna see? You're gonna see more evidence that the world is a bad place. Your brain is actually gonna make sure it thinks that that's relevant and that's what you should be seeing. So no surprises that I turned up to this meeting with Lucas, and I was expecting it to be a bad meeting, so I noticed everything that proved I was right. A type of selective attention that we know of as confirmation bias. We look for evidence that confirms our expectations. He turned up looking for opportunities for collaboration. Magically, that's what he saw. Now, I'm not saying that, you know, you can just say, everything is awesome in front of the mirror in the morning, and everything will be awesome. I'm not saying that. It's obviously not true. But I am saying that if you don't want to miss the good stuff, it helps to be deliberate about the intentions that you have top of mind as you go into anything that matters to you. I'm not saying you do this all the time, but a conversation that's maybe, you know, with someone who's been a bit of a jerk to you in the past, right? If you go in expecting them to be a bit of a jerk, what are you gonna see? Yes, jerkiness. I think that's a word. Now, I'm not saying they're not a jerk, but I am saying that if you're more deliberate about what is a more positive aim for this conversation than I want to prove myself right that he's a jerk. Like, maybe there is, as in my Lucas meeting, I could have said this meeting is not set up as I would like, but what is my aim here? My aim is to bring the people dimension. I could look out for opportunities to do that. Like, that's really my aim. You know, I can look for ways to bridge different perspectives, make sure everybody's being heard. If I decided that was my aim, I would have seen different gorillas. I could have checked my attitude, my assumptions, and say, yeah, I know you think that video conference is a terrible idea. Okay, why is that you're assuming that? Because you had a terrible video conference once 10 years ago, and it's caused a deep trauma. Now, what would be a different assumption? Could you set aside your grumpiness? Yes, I could. I could say, you know what, even if the tech fails, we'll figure it out. We'll get on the conference call. And failing all of that, because you might be thinking, yeah, but come on, let's be realistic. you know, I'm not going to remember to do that. If you do nothing else, you can say to yourself, okay, what do I want to notice? Where do I want to put my attention? I like the alliteration. It helps me when I'm remembering in the morning and I'm thinking about the most important thing that lies ahead. I think, what's my aim? What attitude do I want to have? Are there any assumptions I need to challenge here? Failing all that, walking in, forgot to do that. Okay, where do I want to put my attention? What do I want to notice? And I have to say that using this, I've never really had a bad meeting in the same way that I did with Lucas, again, because even if you're in the middle of something and it's going horribly wrong, and you forgot to do this whole intention setting process beforehand, you can still say, okay, what do I want to notice? I want to notice things I can learn from this incredibly bad meeting. And if you decide to learn, then you'll see things to learn. And that was my choice when I was lying on the floor with my shoe in one more piece than it should have been in. I had a choice to say, okay, what do I want to notice as I get back up? Do I want to see all of the frowns that make me feel like I'm a complete idiot? Or do I want to look out for the smiles and the signs that they're on my side, that they think this is actually kind of funny and it sort of humanized me a little bit? And if I did that, well, that's what I did, without knowing the science behind it at that point, actually. I got up, decided to see the humor, look for the humor, look for the sympathy, and that enabled me to carry on. So I'd like you to now take a moment to think and talk to the neighbor next to you. Think about something that's coming up for you tomorrow, or, I don't know, next week. Think about something where it matters that you do a good job. Think about what intention you would like to have top of mind. Maybe it's an aim, maybe it's an assumption that you can challenge, maybe it's simply something that you want to notice in that conversation that will help you reset your filters. 1 minute conversation with your neighbor. Amazing conversation that you've just started. It's my bad fairy dust coming across your gorgeous conversations. I promise you'll get a chance to carry on the conversation in a second. So hold that thought. What is the question that's going to help you remember that your mental starting point is going to determine what you perceive? Maybe it's one of these on the wall, maybe that you've got a different version. For me, just what do I want to notice is really helpful in the smallest of moments when I'm, you know, grumpy because, I don't know, the traffic is bad or the train is late. I was in a taxi this morning. I had to take a taxi because I was, you know, I'm still only just starting to walk again. And the taxi driver was, you know, the type, just really, really grumpy. Because I first said the convention center, and then I said, oh no, I think I need the entrance on Market Street. And he said, no, the convention center is not on Market Street. So we ended up getting into this conversation. Conversation is a glorified word for it, obviously. But I thought, okay, what do I want to most notice here? And so I thought, okay, because if I just stay with this top of mind, this is going to set what I see. So I thought, okay, I'm going to notice three good things in the next few minutes. Ugh. And you can do it through gritted teeth and it still works. I thought, right, okay, I see a person helping someone else with a bag and I see that the sun is out and that's kind of unexpected and lovely, and I actually realize that we are in the right place and it's going to be fine. And then my mood is reset. So if you do nothing else, then experiment with that. Okay. So that's how we can actually shift the part of reality that we get to see. Should we talk about something super practical now? Talk about how we get more time in the day. How do we get more time in the day? There's a rustle of anticipation. All right. So I'm going to get you to demonstrate this for me, actually, because it's kind of easy. I'm going to ask you to count to seven out loud with some energy as fast as you can. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Yeah, on my mark. some of you might have read this. It's sort of interesting to see it done in a group of people. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, as fast as you can, on my mark. Are you ready? Go! Fantastic. You're not done yet. Next, I want you to do the same with letters. So you say A, B, C, D, F, G, as fast as you can, with some energy, with some pen women energy. Woo! Are you ready? Go. Excellent, and more energy, yeah, that's great. Okay, now I'd like you to do something that should take about the same amount of time put together, which is to mix them up. So, A1, B2, C3, and so on. What? What? You can do it. Are you ready? As fast as you can, obviously. Yeah. Go. Amazing. You did so well. That's great. Fantastic. Okay, guys. You knocked the ball out of the park on that, because the task was actually not to do what you did. The task was to demonstrate 30 years of research into how the brain handles multitasking. Congratulations. Give yourselves a round of applause. Yes. It turns out that what you just experienced there is not just you. Let me just pull it out to be clear. Which was quicker, doing them separately or mixed up? When did you make more mistakes, doing them separately or mixed up? Right, exactly, that's exactly what the research shows. We tend to slow ourselves down by at least 30%, even on simple tasks, when we're trying to do them at the same time in parallel. We tend to make between 2 and 4 times as many mistakes when we're multitasking. And the truth is, in the real world, when you make mistakes, you have to go back and do them again. So it takes even more time, right? And it also hurts our creativity. It makes us more stressed and all of that. So you might be wondering, well, why? I thought we're women. We're supposed to be able to multitask. You know, that's part of the, there's a trope about that. It turns out that this is really deep and fundamental in the way that our brains work. We have an ability, our conscious brain, to only do one thing at a time. Only do one thing at a time. So when we're thinking that we're doing things in parallel, what we're actually asking our brain to do is switch off numbers, switch on letters, switch off letters, switch on numbers. Anyway, you get the point, right? These tiny switches are so small that we don't notice them. But the thing is that they're there. And each of them takes a bit of mental energy and a bit of time. And that adds up to the hit to our productivity and our performance. So it's kind of unavoidable, the conclusion that actually for tasks that require our conscious attention, we are going to be so much faster. We're going to get so much more done. Or we get our work done quicker if we single task as much as we can. So do one thing at a time. Grandmother's advice coming back again. Do one thing at a time. And that means in reality kind of going offline actually for most of us, right? And that isn't easy. But every minute that we're able to spend with our attention focused on one thing and not distracted by our phone, our browser tabs, by everything that's going on around us, the faster we'll get things done. So it really pays to become a bit jiggy with your phone's airplane mode. It pays to be deliberate about thinking about, oh, maybe I need some big headphones. I used to have these big noise-canceling headphones, great for knocking out ambient distractions and helping me single task. I kept them on even when the batteries ran out, because it was really helpful to say to people, I'm single tasking now. So know that any increase in the amount of single tasking time that you can weave into your everyday will get you faster and smarter work. Now you might be saying, yeah, that's kind of challenging. Do you have any advice on how to make that possible? Well, there's lots of practical advice about, you know, switching off devices and closing down tabs and so on. I will say that one non-obvious thing that is actually helpful when you're trying to do more single tasking is something called batching. It's something that NASA uses with the astronauts on the International Space Station, because they've got a limited amount of time up there. And what they do is they collect together similar types of tasks. If they look at their day, they group together similar types of tasks so that the brain isn't switching mode all the time. So what I mean by that, and when we think about our own work, I think about looking at, what are the calls I need to make today? are the emails that I really need to write today? What's the reading? What's the thinking time? And the more that you can group these things together, the easier it is to stay focused. And if you do nothing else than thinking about blitzing your email 2 or 3 times a day, you'll get it done more quickly than if you're blitzing your email 2 or 3 times a minute. One other thing that I would say is be kind to yourself. You know, most of us have lost the trick. We're online, we're always on all the time, and we kind of like it. It makes us feel connected. I'm not a Luddite. You know, I loved the move from acetate overhead slides to PowerPoint, I'll be honest. You know, that was a progress as far as I was concerned. But there's no doubt that, you know, when we think about our lives, we can sometimes feel a little bit out of control when it comes to technology. And it takes a while to kind of relearn how to focus and stay single tasking mode. You know, when I quit my job to write the book, I thought I was really on top of the whole multitasking thing. And then I was on my own, suddenly much, much more every day. Much harder to resist the temptation of the cat video, I mean the very important research site. And so, you know, I would switch off everything, just like start to, I'm like 90 minutes, gonna write this chapter. And then I'd notice my hand just crawling to the mouse, like it wasn't a part of me, to open everything up again. So I realized I had to actually say, okay, fine, I seem to only be able to do about 5 minutes right now. I got a timer, I put it on my desk, I set it to 5 minutes, I let it count down. I felt good about setting a small goal and achieving that, and that made me feel more motivated to carry on. And that is actually a good way of thinking about personal change in general. We tend to set a goal up here, then not quite manage it, go to the gym every week, every day, every hour, and then we kind of don't manage it and we feel terrible about ourselves and say, oh, that didn't work. Actually, it's much better for our brains if we set up the neurochemistry of reward and achievement. And that means setting small goals, even if we have a lofty big one over here. Bite-sized chunks, tiny goal, achievable, achieve it, feel great, flood your brain with the neurochemistry of achievement. And that is why we feel motivated to carry on. So, start small, be kind to yourself. I'd like you to take 2 minutes now, or maybe one, since you're now able to do things super fast. I'd like you to take a moment to say, what would it take to get a bit more single tasking into your life tomorrow or the day after? And if you are already so hot on this, which some of you might be, think about what it would take to get other people on board with this. Have a quick conversation with your neighbor for a minute. Okay. Have you got something in mind? I know that these are fragments of conversations. You might be wondering why I'm getting you to do it at all. The reason is that I know that you're likely to recall at least 25% more of what I say by you pausing and reflecting a tiny bit on what you've just heard. So it's a brain hack. So there we are. But I hope it starts the conversation and starts you reflecting about what is there practically that you might do. I want to talk about how you boost your intelligence. I mean, you're all super, super, super smart, but you know how there are days when you are firing on all cylinders and you're in the meeting and you say the really funny thing or the brilliant thing and everyone says, yeah, good comment, Caroline. Like, super funny. And then there are days when it comes to you 2 hours later in the restroom, like, that would have been a really good thing to say. So, you know, all of us have in us brilliance and days when we don't seem to be able to bring it forth. Maybe we're tired, maybe the work is just hard. So I want to talk to you about one thing that you can do to make it easier to see your way through when you're stuck. A bit later on in my career, I decided that I was really working a lot with senior teams and boards, and I really loved the work. I was doing definitely the people side, and I was just really enjoying that work to help people be more than the sum of their parts and team development work. And what was happening was I was often finding myself falling into one-to-one conversations with, I don't know, the CEO or CFO or whoever. And the conversations would sometimes get quite deep and personal, like, I don't know what I should be doing with my life, and, you know, I've got this person on my team, and I've got this deep conflict, and I was like, I don't know whether I'm causing deep psychological damage to these people, because I'm not trained. So I thought I should actually get certification as a coach, and so I did, and I went off and did this alongside my job. And it was a sort of sweet disaster. The sweet bit was that I loved it. I loved it so much. Oh my God, I turned out to really love coaching, felt like this was my calling in life. I had to be a coach. This was what I should be, what I should do. The disaster bit was that my company was not a coaching firm. Like, it wasn't set up to be a coaching firm. It sort of had these huge teams and huge projects, and the idea of me doing sort of one-to-one coaching, couldn't see how it would fit. And I was a bit worried about quitting. I was very worried about quitting because I was worried about losing the financial security, because most coaches kind of work on their own and it's much more up and down. And I was actually just worried about losing the sense of belonging. I really liked my colleagues, that kind of sense of affiliation and closeness, which you might have with your colleagues. So I was quite stressed. And on this course, the whole way that coaching courses work is that people get the chance to practice their coaching on each other. And so there's this woman, Jill, who was supposed to practice her coaching on me. And so she had to ask me, give me a real topic that I should coach you on for 15, 20 minutes. And I said, well, my career, solve my career. And she said, oh God, okay. Small topic. So she said, no, okay, so tell me what the problem is. So I told her what the problem was. I told her why it was so, I was so stressed. And I know that you're all kind of thinking, well, this is kind of a first world problem. You know, I'm in a great job, and I did a course that I really liked, so I'm going to have to quit my great job to do the job I really want to do. I mean, you know, it is definitely a kind of first world problem. But it was a big dilemma, so I was quite stressed in talking to her about it. And she said, okay, Caroline, stop. What's the ideal situation? And I was quite pissy with her, because I thought, oh. I said, if there were an ideal situation, I wouldn't need to talk to you about this. She said, okay, calm. She said, okay, stay with this for a moment. Talk to me about what the ideal situation was. And I said, well, magically, I will be a coach, but at this company, and it would all be kind of wonderful. And my colleagues would bring me in to coach their customers and clients. And I started to have some fun talking about what this ideal looked like. It was great. And then what happened was that she said, and what would be the very first small step towards that? And the moment she said that, it was blindingly obvious to me that I should tell all my colleagues that that's what I wanted to do, because there was always a chance that something could be worked out. And I know that is so blindingly obvious, because I was going to quit anyway, right? So what did I have to lose? But the reason that I couldn't see the answer when I was focusing on the problem, and I could see the answer when I focused on the ideal, was not coincidence, it was not circumstance. It was because of this. At any given time, your brain is scanning the room for possible threats and rewards right now. Threats to defend you against with a fight, flight, or freeze response. Rewards to seek out and discover. And thank goodness this has kept the human race safe and alive for millennia. But there are a couple of things you really want to know about what happens when your brain is more focused on the threats in a situation than on the rewards. And the first is that it takes vanishingly little to be treated as a threat by your brain. Anything which undermines your sense of self-worth or social standing is enough to be treated as a threat by your brain. So feeling out of your depth on a task, does that tick the box? Oh yeah. Feeling out of your depth with your career, feeling stressed, being put on the spot, all sorts of things that you might recognize, where your brain actually can treat that as a threat because it makes you feel perhaps a little bit incompetent and out of control. The other thing you really want to know about defensive mode when your brain is more focused on threats than on rewards is that you become dumber. This is terrible. It turns out that when you're in a brain scanner and you get shown even mildly upsetting images, nothing big deal, not being put on your spot with a task you can't solve, there's less activity in your brain's prefrontal cortex, the part of your brain that's responsible for reasoning, for self-control, for planning, for generally being brilliant and nice. So when you're put on the spot and you're facing a challenge you can't solve, you become dumber. Right, now that is a hell of a shame, isn't it? Because it's exactly when you need to step up to the challenge. So the trick is getting out of defensive mode so that you're more focused on the rewards than on the threats in a situation. That's why Jill's question was so brilliant, because what she was doing was getting me to put a positive frame around the situation. She was asking what I call a positive framing question. She said, what is the ideal situation? She gave me a sense of possibility. And she said then, what's the very first step towards that? And that gave me a sense of control, boosting my sense of self-worth and flooding my brain with a sense of reward rather than threat, making it easier to bring the part of my brain that's responsible for sophisticated thinking back online. And suddenly I have an insight on what I can do. There are other positive framing questions that I like. When have I previously solved something like this before, and what does that tell me I can do now? I love that question. It gives you a sense of your inner resources. I also like, if everything's going terribly badly, it's like, okay, there must be one place where things are working well. And there always is something. And then to say, okay, what can I learn from that? All of these questions emphasize possibility and control. So take a moment now to tell the person next to you which of these questions you most like and would like to try in your next meeting or task where you get stuck. All right. This is your last rude interruption. One other thing I would say about these positive framing questions is that if you deploy them in a meeting, you immediately sound like the wisest person in the room. So where are things going well? And tell me, what can we learn from that? When have we faced a problem like this before? And what does that tell us we can do now? Yeah. Okay, I want to finish by quickly saying something about other people's moods, because you can't have a good day if people around you are in a bad mood, right? Well, you can, but it's difficult. So there was a time when, after I'd done this kind of tell everybody at my firm that I wanted to be a coach, it worked out brilliantly. It turned out that within 2 weeks, I had colleagues pulling me in to actually coach their colleagues, coach their clients, coach anyone that they could think of. And it actually ended up being enough work to keep my job, which is fantastic. I ended up staying in my job for 7 years longer as a result. One time I was working with a group of four attorneys, coaching them, and I was in Paris. And it was a lovely little setup because I was coaching them, the four of them, but they were also coaching each other because you know how amazingly brilliant you are when you're giving other people advice? That's partly because you're not threatened by other people's problems, right? So you're suddenly able to kind of think clearly when you're talking to other people about their problems. Anyway, so nice little session. And actually, I say that four people were there, but actually it was only three because one of them was late. And what wasn't so good about that was the way that she came in after an hour, which was like this. Slams the door open. Didn't know it was possible to slam a door open. Slams the door closed. Horse noises. Gets her phone out. Says, oh, when's the next one of these? Oh, so annoying. I can't make it. Oh, so annoying. Great. I watched in amazement as you had this sort of ripple effect off everyone. Everyone around her started to kind of say the same sort of thing and make the same kind of noises even. They started to say, they're so annoying. I can't make it either. I knew they could make it because we talked about it at the beginning of the session. So what was happening was something that you know and I know already, which is that people's emotions are amazingly contagious. Like this is part of who we are as human beings. It helps us live in big societies. But it does mean that if someone comes into a room in a bad mood, it sort of spreads like a toxic cloud, doesn't it? And that's what was going on here. So I had this moment where I thought, this is terrible, this is going to go really badly wrong, it's going to be the worst coaching session ever. But then I thought, well, if she's contagious, so am I, right? So I thought, okay, fine. I need to project something positive really quickly into the room. I will say that it was Paris. It was actually also Valentine's Day. So when I was thinking about a positive emotion to project into the room, what do you think came to mind? Love. Yeah. I didn't say I'm about to project love at you suckers. But I did sit there quietly just for a second. I had a half second to do this. Feel my feet on the floor. I noticed, okay, what is there that I can say I really enjoyed about working with them? What is it I'd say I loved about working with them to that point? Because there was plenty I could think about. I had that in mind. I inhabited it. I put a smile on my face, I'll be honest as well, just throwing everything into the pot. And I noticed a sort of settling in the room. It happened within, I would say, 30 seconds, and we were able to get back on track. Now, the more skeptical among you might be saying, yes, but Caroline, wouldn't that have happened anyway? Because she couldn't have stayed at that level of, ah. So I would say, you definitely can't, I'm just telling you that today. I would say that that could be true, but if I projected my angst into the room, what would have happened? I would have escalated the situation rather than dampened it. And you might also say, well, how can you just decide to project love at someone who's being so bloody annoying, right? Honestly. And that's where it helped me to know one last thing, which is something psychologists call the fundamental attribution error. And the way it works is this. If I turn up to work and I feel I'm cranky and I'm not very efficient, I know it's because I didn't sleep well last night. I know that in myself, bad circumstances are down to bad behavior is down to bad circumstances. In other people, in you, for example, dear one, whose name I don't know, if you turn up and you're cranky, I think you're a horrible person and possibly really inefficient. And you're probably not, right? In other people, we attribute bad behavior to bad character instead of bad circumstance. That's the attribution error. And the truth is that only 1% of the population is a psychopath. So it's statistically unlikely that someone who's behaving badly in front of you is actually a psychopath. It's statistically likely that something has put their brain into defensive mode, so they're not able to be at their best. So what I would say to you is what I did right then, which is to say, okay, let me assume good person, bad circumstances, and say, I wonder what's put her brain into defensive mode, right? I don't have to become a psychotherapist at that point. But I can just come up with a silly story if I need to. I can say, maybe her cat vomited on her, you know, this morning. This cat is not dead, it's just resting. Come on, I'm British, I get one Monty Python joke. So I ask myself what could have put them into defensive mode. Now, that doesn't make them a brilliant person, but it does change my demeanor. And that is enough to infect them. It changes the space between us. And that can be enough to turn a tricky conversation in a more positive direction. So to recap, you can shape your reality by being deliberate about the intentions you have top of mind as you go into anything. You can make the hours go faster, further and faster by single tasking. You can boost your intelligence and creativity on demand by using some positive framing questions. And you can make everybody behave nicer, perhaps including yourself, by assuming good person, bad circumstances. And if you do these things systematically, you're going to have more good days, and your good days are going to be better. And I think that that matters because the way that we spend our days is the way that we spend our lives. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Caroline. That was really tremendous. Now, we're going to give you an opportunity to ask questions, but let me start off by giving you my question, which is, Caroline, do you actually take your own advice, or are you just one of those good scientists that like to observe the species engage in your good advice?
That's a very good, very fair question. Actually, I will say that I do take all of the advice that's in the book. I initially wrote a book that was twice as long, and I used a couple of filters to take out some content. And one was, is this something that is replicated across lots and lots of studies, lots of scientific studies? And the other one was, honestly, do I do this myself? Because if I don't do it myself, then who am I kidding? So that's why all of the things that I preach are so small that you can do them whatever your setting, you know, whatever your job is, whatever seniority you are. Try to focus on the things that are so ridiculously easy to do, they only take a few seconds. And part of that outcome has come from me just trying to use this stuff myself over decades now.
Well, great. Now, we're going to take a couple questions before everybody leaves. So if you do have a question, we'll take a couple questions at one of the three mics around the room. So just go to a mic and ask a question. I know we're kind of running a bit late. So are there any questions? Yes.
Hi. My question is how do you balance the potential of, say, let's say you hate folding laundry. So you can multitask by doing other things. So it might take a little longer, but it becomes a more enjoyable activity, and then you're in a better mood. So it may not be the most efficient, but is the end game better than single tasking in the first place?
I think that's a great question. You've got to know what you're trying to achieve, right? And actually, there's great research out there on something called temptation bundling, which is to say that it's a really smart idea to bundle together something that you don't want to do with something that you actually enjoy. So for example, maybe you really like reading trashy novels or watching trashy TV shows. You want to go to the gym, but you kind of don't seem to manage it. So you say, okay, I only get to watch trashy movies or TV shows or read trashy books while I'm on the treadmill. And actually, that's been shown to be a really, really effective. And you know, do you go as fast on the treadmill as if you were not reading? No, maybe not. But I think it's good to know what it is you're trying to achieve. All I'm saying on the single tasking point is, if it's a task that requires really high performance or something you really need to get done quickly, and a lot of things we do at work, just you know, you need to kind of just sit and think for a little bit. There's some stuff which is automatic, but actually there's a lot where you need a bit of a breakthrough insight. And if you need that, then you're going to get to that more quickly and more effectively if you're single tasking. So yeah, carry on with the folding laundry with the
last question. Yes.
I'm going to make this two in one. Building on what she just asked, if there is a task at work that, like, I just absolutely hate doing expense reports, I learned a new term about a week ago, eat the frog, like make yourself do that first.
Yeah.
And also, do you make lists?
Do I make lists? I'll take the second one. Yeah, I absolutely make lists because your brain only has a small amount of what's known as working memory, which is the amount of information you can hold in mind at once. You can actually only hold three or four things in mind at once. So if at the back of your mind is, I must fold the laundry, it's taking up one of those slots of three or four things. So the more you can subcontract the job of remembering what the hell you're supposed to be doing to a piece of paper or an app or whatever, the more headspace literally you have in order to solve an actual problem. And the other thing I would say is on automatic tasks versus deliberate tasks is that, you know, things that we do automatically, perhaps like folding laundry, we can do in parallel with other things. So there is a little bit of thinking about, is this a task that actually I can do on autopilot, in which case I might be able to do it in parallel with other things, or is it expense reports where maybe a mistake would be a real problem, in which case I then do need to focus. In which case, if something comes to mind as you're doing one, have a process for a parking lot where you can put the thought that comes to mind and you can get it out of your head so that it's not taking up one of your tiny amounts of working memory in your brain.
I keep saying this, but one more.
Hi, thank you for this today. It's been very valuable. And as I was listening to you talk about how to, if you're in a room and you're trying to set a good tone or influence people through your emotions, I found myself reflecting on some of those personality quizzes you take. Oh, you're red, or you're green, or you're blue. And the most recent one I took, they were specifically saying, what's important to know is about yourself, so that you don't, they did a two thing where they said, and this is where you spend time pretending to be someone you're not. And how much energy are you wasting there?
Yeah.
And I'm trying to think of how does that blend with what you're talking about, like trying to put yourself in the right headspace. If that's, what if you are that person that walks in the room and goes, oh, I'm not, I don't want to be here and I'm cranky and everything. And like, that's you.
Yeah.
As a default, let's say.
Yes.
So how
yes.
do you change that if you're not a coach, but you're leading people and you have to coach?
Yeah. Well, I think it really helps to, I mean, the starting point, which is what you're inherently saying, is self-awareness. You have to know that about yourself. You have to know, so I know that if I haven't eaten food, I get cranky. And so with my teams, I need to say, look, you know, if I start to get a bit snappish, just ask me whether I've eaten something recently. You know, it actually helps to label and to name what's going on. The first time that I actually did, I remember I was running a team and I came in and I was really annoyed because there'd been problems with public transportation. I was in London at the time. And I was working with a young guy who is now actually a member of parliament in Ireland. So he was a smart guy. He came to me and he said, look, Caroline, I know that your anger is not directed at us, right? We know it's about the trains. But if you come in this way and you are radiating this stuff at us, we can't help but be affected by it. And so he said, look, obviously there are going to be problems, but just have a way to reset. It gave me pause for thought. I was like, okay, one of the best ways to reset is to name it, to label it and say, well, that was, you know, and then to have a question which gets you focused on what's positive. And, you know, for me, it's something like, you know, what really matters here, or what is the ideal situation, and what is my first step towards that. So I think self-awareness is the starting point, being willing to call it out, have some humor, some humility, and have a kind of go-to strategy for getting yourself, asking the right question to get yourself focused on what matters again. There's a lot more to say about that. My gosh, big topic, but thanks for asking the question.
Well, this has been a great session. Caroline will be outside signing copies of her book, How to Have a Good Day. Have a good day today and more days to come. Thank you.